This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Division 2, Division 3 podcast. And what an episode we have. What an exciting night of Division 3 quarterfinal action. On Wednesday night, we were in person at the York Cabrini game. Myself, I was there. Kyle Devitt up there up north attended Amherst versus Tufts. And Josh Davey was holding it down here in the Inside Lacrosse offices in Baltimore. What a night we had. Three of the away teams win their games. It's just an all-around exciting time to be a fan of Division III lacrosse. Josh, when you look at these scores from last night, what's going through your head? What's your takeaway?
These teams are all so good. They're so good. And nothing says that more than teams that we are not used to talking about, you know, in terms of the Final Four teams. Teams we're not as familiar with, right? Like, is there a team that we know less about that has made the Final Four of Division III lacrosse than Williams in the last 10 years? Probably not. So to have three first-timers, so to speak, in Amherst, Williams, and Cabrini, and then the perennial powerhouse Salisbury, who's been there before, is really exciting for the sport and shows just the parity across the board and the depth of the NESCAC. And Cabrini was the one Pool B team and not in a conference, and they've been knocked for, you know, winning their conference for 26 straight years, and they're really, you know, flexing on us right now. So to have three teams that have not been there before crossing that line, I think is pretty cool and should get all Division III fans really excited to, you know, welcome a new brand and sort of some new faces into the Division III world.
What an awesome night. Let's just run down the scores real quick of these quarterfinal games. Amherst beat Tufts 13-11, a NESCAC rematch in that one. Williams with the double OT win over RIT 12-11. Those are both road teams that upset their opponents. Salisbury, the perennial power, basically taking it to Denison 19-10, using a lot of really big scoring runs to break that game open. And then another overtime contest and another road team getting the victory. Cabrini 11, York 10. Kyle, we're going to start with the North and the Tufts Amherst game that you were at. Amherst winning this rematch 13-11. What's your overall takeaway?
First, I want to kind of echo a sentiment I had on Twitter and just thank the D3 teams for accommodating me. There's not a ton of space at a lot of their stadiums, and you know, I'm the last thing they need to worry about. It's like finding a spot for me to sit there and, you know, tweet away or type away. And they got me a table right behind the Amherst bench. So an unbelievable experience. And I want to thank Tufts Athletics for that access. But my takeaway is that I think Amherst can win the national championship. That's like number one. Number two, I think that Amherst in particular can do it because of their depth, which I think is not something that a lot of teams consider when we're talking about who can win at the beginning of the season. You know, I think that the depth of your squad, I mean, this is a team that has three goalies that have started games. Chad Simmons, who started for them when they beat RIT, was dressed for this game. But Gib Versfeld was ready to go and had been putting up huge save totals in the last couple games. I also saw Cam Mitchell start against Bates less than a month ago. So that's how deep this team is. They have three starting caliber goalies. And when I saw Mitchell, he put up 15 saves. Like, I don't know of any other D3 team that can cycle in three goalies and have this kind of success. They've got a great faceoff guy and Dylan Finazio. I think that people probably slept on Amherst because we might have overrated them a little bit after the RIT win, and then they had, ironically, two losses to the team they're going to play in the semifinals, and that's Williams.
I saw a tweet during this game that said, you could put a 20-second shot clock on Tufts and Amherst and it wouldn't change the way they play at all.
It's true. It's 100% true. And the game actually played out like that for the first 15 minutes. And then the goalies just shut the door on everything. It's not like the teams played differently, but they did start, as the game wore on, especially in the second half, to kind of milk their possessions, which again, in the interview with Coach Thompson, he doesn't, even he says, I don't think anyone expected us to use the whole shot clock. And also, no one expected Tufts to use the whole shot clock. And they did because they knew that that's what they had to do to change how the game was being played. And both teams had a vested interest in drawing the game out, especially when Tufts was going on their run in the third quarter, you know, five straight goals. They brought it within one twice. And everyone in the stadium thought they were going to bring it all the way back because that's what Tufts has done all season.
You know, Tufts had those dramatic wins in the NESCAC tournament. So there's no surprise that people were kind of anticipating that that was going to happen again in this one. Kyle, you talked about the depth and you talked specifically about the goalie position, but you mentioned Dylan Finazzo. Remember, he wasn't even, you know, he was hurt for part of the year. He wasn't even the primary faceoff specialist. Juan Gonzalez, who took two draws last night, worked out really well for them in the time when he was their primary guy. So there's really, you know, that's kind of part of the equation of what it takes to win in May, and Amherst clearly has it. There's no doubt about that. Kyle, can you just talk about the atmosphere and the overall, you know, it's a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people talking, particularly this year, about the NESCAC teams playing each other in the tournament and how, you know, maybe they should have been seeded to avoid when they met in the tournament and things like that. But can you just talk about this environment and what you felt kind of being there in the atmosphere of this game?
I mean, being in the middle of it is surreal. Walking across the field while the teams are warming up through the middle is an electric experience. The crowd's not even there yet, but there is so much going on in terms of, you know, you can see the preparation of the players. You can see the coaches milling about on the sideline, game day staff getting ready. I mean, there's no difference between a super high level D3 game like this one and a high level D1 game. You know, the atmosphere is the same. The stands are a little smaller, but even at Tufts, it was packed. There was people lined across the fence on the far side, you know, watching this game, taking it in, and because everyone knew Tufts would eventually make a run, and then they did. And once they did, the whole crowd, just everything, ground balls, takeaways, great passes, there was a pop from the crowd every time. So it's one of those experiences that I can't take for granted as someone that just covers it, you know, as a neutral, you know, journalist, I guess. But it's also, if you're a fan of lacrosse and you were at this game, you had a good time. It's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of heated rivalry between these teams. Being right next to the sub box, I probably heard some stuff I wasn't supposed to hear, but I love that. I love being in that kind of atmosphere, and it was super intense from the opening whistle to the last whistle.
Yeah, I had a similar experience up at York with how intense the crowd was, and just you could feel the energy. People lined up along the fence, students, you know, the women's lacrosse team was there supporting the men's lacrosse team. Awesome atmosphere. But Kyle, you're talking about Tufts and I'm sorry, Amherst, and, you know, you think that they can win a national championship. And I think most people agree with you now after, you know, seeing them beat Tufts. They have an opponent, though, that they have lost to two times ahead of them, and that is Williams. First, we're going to get to Coach John Thompson. Hear him talk about the game a little bit, but Kyle, after the break, that's what I want to talk about, is what does Amherst have to do to beat Williams?
I honestly didn't have many expectations. You know, we were playing a bunch of zone, and, you know, I thought both goalies in the first quarter played great. They played great through the entire day, but didn't have any expectations. You know, you think on paper this is going to be a 17-16 game.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it very easily could have been a 17-16 game. Without some of both of their the goalie stops. But, you know, I think we came out and were just sort of very businesslike, you know, just one at a time. And you know, our guys, that's one thing I'll say, is throughout the day they never lost their composure. You know, that would have been really easy to lose their composure when Tufts put that run on us in the third and fourth quarter. They just never lost the composure. And I think there's a lot to be said about playing some juniors and seniors in those moments, you know, the experience. And but, you know, that first quarter, we certainly jumped out to an early lead thanks to Nas. I mean, Dylan Finazzo was spectacular at the stripe today. So,
all right, Kyle, we heard from Coach Thompson. Now we're looking at the D3 North semifinals. Williams beating RIT last night. You know, I think this might be the game that surprised people most when they looked at this quarterfinal round, but Williams has had a heck of a year, a historic year, earning their first NCAA Division III semifinal berth. Talk about this game, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what is in store for the third time around between Amherst and Williams.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've talked about this before. One of our freelance writers, Chris Rosenthal, he had a work poll or a work bracket, and he asked for advice. One of his coworkers asked him for advice, and he went to me, and I was like, well, I think RIT can win if you're looking for somebody that maybe is a lock to make the finals. But if you're looking for a sleeper, it's Williams. And funnily enough, they ended up meeting, and Williams, the sleeper, took it in double OT. I think when I saw this result, and I tweeted out a gif of just an explosion riding across the earth. And Josh, I think you did something similar, right?
I was shocked, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know if shocked is the right word, because I watched all of RIT's game against Union on Saturday, and they did not look like the RIT that I have seen play at times this season. They looked rattled. They had trouble getting the ball up and out. And if you play like that against Williams, you're going to lose. And you're going to lose because Williams' strength is in their defensive midfield. I think you're – honestly, this is going to sound a little weird. I think you're better off dodging against their poles than you are against their short stick D-minis, because they'll just hold you. They'll just push you out and get you out of position. But the thing that separates Williams is they have this amazing attack unit of Jake Hayes, Corey Lund, and Kevin Stump. Stump got the double OT winner. And they also have kind of the I think every D3 team has the really big midi who's like, what are you doing here? Why are you playing D3? What are you doing? You're huge. You're fast. You have a bomb. What are you doing here? Every great D3 team that wins a championship has that guy. And that guy for them is Brendan Hoffman, a junior from Darien, Connecticut. He is a monster. He is the guy that they went to in the overtime against Tufts in the NESCAC championship to get the shots after their ball movement. And the ball movement is created by the attack constantly moving. You know, Hayes is a guy with 62 assists. The Lund and Stump are primarily shooters and scorers, but Hayes is just a guy that moves around so effectively that you have to lock him out in order to have a chance to lock out the rest of the Williams offense. And one of the things that Amherst did a lot in the Tufts game is they played a zone and didn't cover X. So they, because Tufts doesn't run a ton of cutters, they run a lot of exchanges, and the Amherst defense felt like they could, you know, hang with that. And they did, but as soon as they kind of slowed down a little bit, they couldn't, and that's when Tufts made their run. So I think when you're looking at Amherst versus Williams, Amherst probably should free up those poles to play a little tighter man D, a little more pressure in the six. And I think that if Williams drags it out, like they can and they will do, and that's why they brought Tufts to overtime. They kept it under 15. I think that's the key to the entire game, is making Amherst play all 80 seconds of the shot clock. All of it.
I do think this is going to be a different game. Two stats that stick out to me from the last time Amherst and Williams met was goalie for Williams, Harry Gahagan, had 20 saves in this game. You know, he's a great keeper, but 20 saves is a lot. And Amherst had 11 penalties. So those are two things that are certainly outliers when you're looking at stats from the last time these teams matched up. So I think that if Amherst can shoot a little bit of a higher percentage, obviously, but also stay out of the penalty box a little bit, this could be a completely different game. I think it's going to be an amazing game, but I think that you can start to sort of throw the first two games out the window. And I also think it's really hard to beat a team three times. I have suffered from so many Ravens beating the Steelers two times in a season and then losing in the playoffs. So I feel like Amherst can have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, and if they can clean things up, you know, make that goalie work a little bit harder and stay out of the penalty box, specifically to that last game, which I believe was the NESCAC championship, I think it'd be really interesting.
I love the short stick D middies on both sides of the ball. Like Kyle, you mentioned that. I think that's going to be just a key matchup all around that might go unnoticed when people look at the game and the box score. But, you know, I got to say, Josh, to your point, you know, everything would probably indicate, you know, that Williams is the favorite. They are the favorite in terms of their seeded. You know, they're going to be the home team in this game. They've beaten Amherst twice. But does this kind of flip the script and kind of go against logic? And is Amherst the favorite because you just can't beat a team three times in 1 year? Kyle, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's definitely tough. And we have a piece going up on the site related to Division I and how do you beat a team three times? Like what happens when you play a team three times in a season? I have never played a team three times in any season, so I don't have any personal experience as a coach or a player relating to that. But in terms of analysis, you know, there's more tape. There's more to watch. There's more to pick apart. There's more to create, and there's more to destroy. So I think that, you know, Coach Thompson and his staff are well equipped to do that. They have a lot of pieces. I mean, one of the things that I think struck me when I saw Amherst for the first time this season, and that's when they played RIT and won that incredible game, is the strength of their pulls. And against Tufts, it probably wasn't as apparent as it was when it was against RIT because it was more wide open. And Tufts doesn't do a ton of one-on-one dodging. It's a lot of, again, it's a lot of exchange, pick, roll off the ball, move the ball, get it to the open guy kind of offense. Williams will do that, but I think Williams also has a really strong midfield driving from the top. And one of the things that Amherst struggled with was an ISO one-on-one on the high wing, which is what Tufts did when they absolutely needed a goal last night. And if Amherst doesn't adjust that and send a slider quicker, then we could be, you know, this could be very well be a third loss to Williams. I'm not going to discount the ability of Williams to pull the game out at all. But again, more tape is more tape. And I think Coach Thompson's squad, despite the huge win by Williams last night, the way that they played against Tufts, I think Amherst is the favorite going into the game.
The thing last night that really stood out to me, and it's kind of relevant here when we're talking about playing a team three times, but man, this tournament is brutal for these athletes. They've played three games in 1 week, three fairly high-level games. You know, maybe you got a, you know, for these teams, a second-round game that was kind of a cakewalk a little bit, but three games, the first quarter of the York Cabrini game that I was at, you could kind of tell that the teams were just a little bit, you know, they needed to get the muscles going and, you know, just nursing some stuff. So really just kind of see how that plays. You know, really, like, as much as we're talking about game planning, it's going to be a war of attrition. It's going to be the team that just brings it, the team that's healthiest. The team that's a little tougher maybe is probably going to pull it out. And I think that's going to be the case for most of these semifinals. But I want to transition that to the South. We're talking about who's going to win this North semifinal. And we've talked so much all year about how the North is really good. But there is the question of, is this all a moot point because Salisbury is just going to win it all? They're the only team that came out of this quarterfinal round with a really decisive, clear victory. They're the team that has who I would say is the player of the year on their roster in Josh Melton. They are the team that has been there before, literally the only team that has been there before at this level. And they pretty much just handled Denison, a team that was under the radar but very good all year. They handled them 19-10. So part of me is just, you know, even though I think I've said all year that I think the champion's going to come out of the North, I mean, it's really tough to pick against Salisbury in this field of four. And just looking at their win last night, again, you know, they had another player who kind of stands out, you know, Cross Ferrara. He had 6 points, 5 goals, and an assist. That ties a career best for him. You know, he's their number three guy in points for Salisbury, but again, he's not the guy that you necessarily think of right away when you think of the Salisbury offense. One thing that was really interesting, 13 unassisted goals for the Seagulls in the win against Denison. They had just a bunch of scoring runs that were just way too tough for Denison to handle. you know, you got to look at this and just think, man, Salisbury again is setting up for what we're used to most years.
Yeah, I think when you look at the unassisted goals, it just shows, you know, nothing against Denniston. But I think just the in terms of these quarterfinal games, there was certainly the most distance between talent between Denniston and Salisbury compared to the other three games. So, you know, when I think unassisted goals, sometimes you think of like unselfish play. But when you have 13 of them, you're doing something right. You're just better than the other team. So I think these guys were able to beat their men off their first dodge quickly before a slide could come. And they're just athletic. And Salisbury plays such an open style. They put two guys up top and set picks and try to make the defense see where they're going to slide. And, you know, that lack of communication and, you know, just disorganization that it inherently brings to a defense is really hard. And, you know, they're scoring 19 goals. They scored 19 goals against Lynchburg the game before. I'm sure they scored 19 or more before that as well. So their offense is firing all cylinders. You know, the only thing that sticks out to me in terms of a weakness for Salisbury is I'm not 100% sold on Brandon Warren yet. I think that he's had a lot of ebbs and flows this season. He made 6 saves in this game, and, hey, he only needed to make 6 of them to still win by 9 goals. Salisbury is also just a monster at the faceoff X. So I think when you're, you know, looking for Salisbury Cabrini, it's going to be an awesome game. I know we're about to dive in a little bit to the Cabrini York game you went to, Matt, but I think Salisbury certainly has an inherent advantage just because they've been there before. They're going to be, it's just going to be another game for them. Whereas Cabrini, this is their first time there. First time they've made it this far. But they're a really, really talented team too.
Definitely, and Kyle, Josh, to build on your point, Brett Malamphy, 19 of 23 faceoffs. I mean, just look at the stat lines. 46 ground balls for Salisbury. That was more than double what Denniston had. Obviously, a lot of that is due to the faceoff X. You had turnovers. Salisbury only had 11. Clearing, they had a really good clearing day, 13 of 15. That's something that we've consistently seen are some pretty interesting clearing numbers from some really good teams, but Salisbury was really clean there. Shots 55. Salisbury is really good, and we talked about before we hit record, we were talking about who's the player of the year, and it's got to be Josh Melton. He's got 116 points, really, really balanced numbers, which I think is, you know, one of those things. I think when you're talking about postseason, when you're talking about awards and season-long awards, postseason awards, players who are balanced generally get more credit than players who are a pure goal scorer or, you know, a guy who can run an offense. It just gets a little more love than that guy who just puts in 90 goals.
116 points is scratching the surface of some NCAA records as well. So not only what he is doing is historic in terms of this season, but in terms of the NCAA record books, you know, if he scores 10 points in the last two games of the season, assuming they win, and who knows how whatever they go on to whatever Salisbury's, you know, arc and trajectory is, you know, if he scores 10 more points this season, he's in the top 10 points in a season of all time in Division III lacrosse, which is pretty cool.
Jason Kaufman, who's number 5 on the points list. Everyone knows him, the Salisbury great. In 1995, he had 134 points, which that's definitely a reach, but just kind of shows you some perspective of how good of a season that he has had. But they don't have, you know, just this easy path to the championship. They got to play Cabrini, and Cabrini was, I was so impressed with Cabrini last night and their win against York, an 11-10 victory. They were down 6-1 at the half. They entered the fourth quarter. I'm sorry, 5-1 at the half. Entered the fourth quarter trailing 7-4. And then they kind of just flipped the switch and just turned it into their game. They were playing York's game for about 2.5 quarters. Then they just started playing a faster pace. They dictated the momentum where York was kind of a little bit sitting back. Maybe they should have been a little more aggressive during that time. But Cabrini just kind of got all the momentum and made it their game. And Jordan Krug, he took over. You know, the star players got to be star players. And that's what Coach Steve Colfer said after the game. He said, it's not rocket scientists. It's not rocket science. Your star players got to score goals. That's what happened. And it ended with a fairly controversial goal in overtime, a dive across the crease from Mike Gersbeck, and that sealed the victory for Cabrini. There's a lot of stuff that really stood out to me about Cabrini that I really, really liked. Mentioned Krug. Just his ability to be a physical dodger is just really, really, you know, he was able to kind of just, that's why he had 2 diving goals. You know, he was able to kind of body up his guy, get that leverage and get his toes like right on the crease, jump across and score.
He's like a lefty Dylan Malloy. That's what he reminds me of a little bit, just the way he uses his body.
Yeah, that's a really – and with a lot more hair. So he's got that going for him. And, you know, Cabrini certainly had this nothing-to-lose mentality for that last 30 minutes. So that's why they were taking these kamikaze dodges toward the net, and the ref was counting them as good goals. You know, that we've seen that call go different ways all year. Rightfully so for Cabrini. It worked once, so why not do it again? And then why not do it again in overtime? Kyle Tucker was just a really good off-ball guy who scored three goals. Really just had a knack for, you know, when the midfielder dodged, he was able to pop out, get free. Then it was automatic for him right there. Krug, he has 100 points on the season. That's basically, he's the second player in program history to reach that plateau. Corey Elmer was the other one, and everyone remembers how good he was.
He was unbelievable.
But really, you know, the thing that makes me, you know, if I'm Salisbury, the thing that makes me worried is goalie Riley White. He had 15 saves. 10 of them came in the first half where he was just really lights out. You know, if this was any other goalie performance, York was going to run away with this game. But Riley White kept them in it at halftime until the offense could kind of figure out a way to assert itself in the second half, which they did. Just really impressive performance. Outside shots, you know, it was an automatic save for him, but he was really good one-on-one. You know, there was a face-off win that, you know, York just took to the house, and he just gobbled that up. Really good and tight, really good everywhere. Very active in the clearing game as well. Just really, really impressive performance from him. And junior Tommy DeLuca, he had two calls, turnovers, but was really just a presence in everything that he did throughout the night, kind of stifling the York offense. Just really complete game for Cabrini.
Yeah, I mean, when you have two guys in the stat sheet, the DeLuca kid had an assist as well. And then you have a guy, Kevin Layden, who gets an assist as well. When you're talking about one-goal games, you know, Layden is a kid who only has 8 points on the season. DeLuca has five as a long pole. I mean, we talked about the stars need to shine the brightest, but you also need some of those, you know, those third-line middies, those LSMs, those defenders. You know, in games like this, you need a little bit of a push from not the bottom, because that has, like, a negative connotation, but those guys who are not your big guys, right? Like, you need that bench contribution in the NBA playoffs right now. You need that extra little push. So to get, you know, a couple point here and there in an 11-10 game, you know, it's a difference in the game.
The last 7 minutes of this game were just awesome. So much fun to be at. The crowd was really into it. You know, you had one side of Cabrini parents because it's not that far away for them. You had the other side of the York students and parents and fans. So it was really just they were trading goals, and it was just kind of you knew that who's going to have one more at the end is going to be the winner, obviously. Timmy Brooks getting into the game. He's been injured. He basically went out there for man up. Took one shot, scored, left the game. Had the best day ever that you could possibly have. Really just so much fun. But the dive is something we've got to address here and talk about. Now, Kyle, let's set this up by talking about the Limestone Tampa game that you watched the live stream of in the D2 quarterfinals. What happened in that scenario for the dive?
So, to me, it looked remarkably similar to Cabrini's game winner, which I also watched on a stream. So take that for whatever it's worth. But in the Tampa Limestone game, we're in the first overtime. Limestone scored with like 18 seconds left to tie the game after being down for basically the entire contest. It was a wild game regardless of the overtime finish, but that's what we're talking about. So the ball comes down, it cycles a little bit in the first overtime period to Tampa, and Andrew Q, Tampa's ostensibly best player, takes the ball and realizes he has to go to cage because the clock's running down. He initiates his dive from behind GLE. He gets hit as he's going, and he makes contact with the goalkeeper but buries the shot. The dive rule call is that if you dive towards the goal mouth and make contact with the keeper, you're getting a penalty. That's what was called. The keeper definitely stepped into him as he dove. I didn't see that as much in the Cabrini goal, but the it totally turned everything around. It took Limestone another overtime to win it. So, I mean, I guess you could say ball don't lie because they didn't score in that period. But it was shocking. I mean, it was such an incredible play. It was a gutsy play. It's a risky play. And Q scored and had it taken away. And I can't imagine what that feels like. And then Tampa loses after putting up, you know, a remarkable performance against a, let's not forget, undefeated Limestone team. They put them to the sword. They were on top of them for most of the game, leading by as much as 5 goals. So to see it end like that for Tampa because of a dive rule call was brutal. Just as brutal as I'm sure it was for York fans and for the York bench to see Cabrini score on a dive goal and beat them. You know, so I've been ranting against this dive rule since before the season started on my other podcast, In the Crease with Dan Aburn, but I am happy to do it again because I don't understand how refs are adjudicating it, especially in key moments where it's a diving overtime goal. I feel like you just let that go. You know, like that's like calling a foul on the last shot in the NBA Finals, and it's a 3. You know, like, I don't know. I feel really bad about it. I feel really bad for teams that lose that way, you know, especially if it's called back. And obviously the Cabrini one wasn't, but how do you not call that back versus the Tampa one? I don't know. I hate it.
Levels of it. I'm with you. I don't like it either. I coach a high school team here in Baltimore, and all season there's only 2 dives. One was a good goal, and the other was actually in our last game of the season. We were playing our rival, and we were up by a goal or two, and a kid on the other team dove just blatantly into my goalie's legs, and they called a flag, and we were able to run the clock out and win the game. So, and in the high school, it's not as much, but it's funny that we're talking about this because I feel like, yeah, we've talked about it a lot. It hasn't been that – it's not that common of a play. I don't know. Maybe you guys have watched a lot more than me. I don't feel like I hear or see it that often, but it's interesting that when the times – you know, the clock's ticking down and your season's on the line, that's what people are going to, something that is so controversial and so – you know, it's putting a lot of pressure on those refs. So I agree with your point, Kyle. Like, how are you going to call – you know, what was the game they called the NCAA game, right? They called a foul on the kid at the end of the game, and he hit 3 free throws, and Virginia went on to win. Like, yeah. You got to let the guys play, but there's definitely levels of, like, blatant and ticky-tacky. And in those moments, I feel like if it's not blatant, you got to let it stand.
And it's definitely weird. Like, you know – I talked to both coaches after the game, and we'll play some of that audio for you in just a moment. You know, Brandon Childs, he was clear, like, we're not going to make this our excuse. They should have made a few more plays to win that game. So it wasn't completely sour grapes about the dive call, but, you know, he was flat out, like, he's like, I think the refs are more likely going to let that slide than they're going to take away a goal in that scenario of a game. Because, Kyle, just the reason that you said, the let them play mentality. Also, Cabrini has a decided advantage, you know, when they're the team that's down. York isn't going to go diving into the crease when they're up by 5 goals. Cabrini has nothing to lose whatsoever. Right. So they're going to go. They did it. I mean, it was 3 dives in this game. It wasn't just the one in overtime. It was 3 of them. I would say one of them I would have thought was a clear no goal. The other 2, including the game winning, I would have been... You could have convinced me maybe either way, and I've seen it called either way, which is exactly the problem that we're discussing here. It's not that clear. You know, so Cabrini was incentivized to do a play that, you know, hey, if we get a penalty or if it doesn't go in, it doesn't really matter that much for us because we're going to lose anyway if we don't do something. York was incentivized to be a little more conservative, which is why, you know, they played, I thought, pretty good defense on those dives. They didn't push the guy in, maybe in the overtime, you just cross-check the guy and do whatever you can to make sure that ball doesn't go in the net. Be a little more aggressive in that situation. But, you know, York played it by the book. Cabrini had a little more leeway where they can just do whatever the heck they wanted to. And they've got the physical bodies that can do that as well. These are some big guys and some physical Dodgers who have the capacity to do that. But the funny thing was, Steve Colfer has even said it, you know, without me prompting it necessarily, he hasn't been a fan of the dive all year, and it just happens to be that he wins a game on three dives. So he said maybe temporarily, at least, he's going to change his mind on the rule. But you know, he definitely sympathized with Coach Childs about how the lack of clarity in that situation, and that's really what we want, is just clarity.
And that's the hardest part about the shot clock, right? Is like, without the shot clock, the dive, I feel like, would be accepted a little bit more. But because it's almost like a last ditch resort, York is being rewarded by holding a team under 80 seconds or whatever it is, right? There's 5-4-3-2-1. I'm not exactly sure the situations in which these dives took place, but like, you know, you work so hard to get that shot clock down to 3-2-1, and then there's a controversial play, and that's where it gets even more frustrating as a coach. So I can totally empathize with Coach Childs, but I'm not surprised that he didn't use that as a cop-out. That's not the kind of guy he is.
So thinking of this, you know, it's not a rule change year per se. However, there are exceptions if, you know, there's something that's, you know, I don't know the exact language, but essentially an emergency situation. Has the dive risen to the level of that kind of emergency situation where the game, you know, the reputation, the fairness, the safety and those things of the game are at stake? Or is it going to take something to happen in Philadelphia Final Four weekend? You know, this is the scenario that Bill Tierney predicted at the beginning of the season, that there's going to be, you know, whether it's a goal turned back or it's going to be a team gets a penalty on that situation, the defending team, or the scoring, or the, you know, offensive team gets a penalty in that situation and the other team scores on that extra man offense. Is that going to be maybe the straw that breaks the camel's back, and it's going to be reassessed this off season, even though it's not a typical rule change year?
I would think the latter, just because, to my point earlier, I don't think it's been – I feel like there's been a week or weekend or two where it's been one play that's been really controversial, but as a whole, I don't think it's been that bad that we need to throw out the book and reassess everything we're doing. I don't know if Kyle has a more hot take on that, though. I feel like he might.
I think you're right. It is the latter, and it's also going to happen. Just mark my words. It's going to happen. It's already happened because it happens in pressure situations. That's the thing. That's what you were just alluding to with the shot clock, with, you know, what's more pressure than championship weekend? Nothing. So I totally expect a dive call to happen, to be controversial, and to possibly get blown by a referee crew. I mean, call me a cynic. I've been predicting it all year, and I think it's coming.
We're going to hear from Coach Colfer, who, you know, it's unbelievable that this is the first time going to the semifinals for that program. I kind of had to check it myself. And York falling just short of that milestone for its program. Those seniors were very emotional. Coach Childs was very emotional after this game. You know, they've done a lot to put that program on the map and to fall this short.
Winningest program in York College history.
Yeah, that class really just did so much. You know, Coach Child's message, he told me his message to them. I'll try to scrounge up that audio, but it was pretty emotional scene at the end of that game. But here's Coach Steve Colfer talking about the win, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the D2 semifinals.
We know we were down 5-1 in that halftime, and that's not insurmountable with shot clock lacrosse, you know what I mean? So I thought, like, we just needed to, you know, play better and faster in the third quarter. I thought we were just a little, I thought we played pretty good defense in the first half, you know what I mean? And I thought the same thing when I watched the film from the last time we played, and we were down 6-0 at halftime. We just weren't scoring the ball, you know what I mean? You got to score the ball, and you got to take advantage of your opportunities. And I thought York played with more bounce in the first half, and we were able to match that bounce in the second half, you know? And I really thought that was the difference. And then we made some, you know, cleared the ball better, you know, and our goal scorer scored the goal ball, you know. I mean, it's not rocket science, you know what I mean? Your best players got to, who've been doing it all year, have to do it in moments like that, and I thought that's what they did. So,
talk a little bit about the Division II semifinals that are going to be this weekend. We talked a little bit about the Limestone victory over Tampa. Their opponent is going to be a first-timer, UIndy. Victors over Belmont Abbey, 14-13. Belmont Abbey was one of those teams at preseason that was going to be in this mix here going into the semifinals. In the north, a lot of NE10 action. Merrimack beat Adelphi, 14-12. And Lemoyne beat Mercy, a team that beat them earlier in the season, 14-4. Kind of in the way that you know, you had you have Salisbury in the South, in the North, in South in D3. You know, Lemoyne kind of has a similar vibe of they're the team that's coming in. I think with the pedigree, but also, you know, the recent run of success and kind of correcting any early season things that maybe had you doubting them, you know, Lemoyne is kind of that team in this D2 round, and they're going to face Merrimack in a wonderful rivalry in college lacrosse for the third time this season and for the final time that these programs are ever going to meet, because Merrimack is going to Division I next year. Kyle, this adds up to a pretty explosive situation, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. And I am absolutely here for it. Lemoyne-Merrimack games are, they are like, it's like watching two brothers fight, you know, but they like really hate each other deep down.
The game ball, dude. Good time.
It really is. It really is. It's very similar. I don't know which team would be which brother because they switch roles so often. I think Lemoyne would kind of, you know, after beating Mercy by 10 goals, looked pretty unkillable. I will say I watched
maybe mountain-esque, would you say?
Yeah, mountain-esque, I would say. I don't know if you can stick a knife through Dan Entman's eye and he won't die, but you know, he's still a great player. I think
I have no idea what you guys are talking about, by the way.
I'm yeah. here for this. This is the D2 talk I needed.
He loves it. He needs it. I think that, you know, Merrimack Lemoyne, it's going to be close. All their games are close because they have such intense, you know, like atmospheres around the team, you know, but it's two different kinds because Merrimack is very, very brash, very in your face, very bump you after the play. Whereas Lemoyne is very, you know, buttoned up, very business, but also really scary at the same time. They have crazy athletes. They have very good pulls. Merrimack has the same, but I think Merrimack leans a lot more on their transition and their offense to win them games, especially this season. So I would expect a pretty explosive game, but I do think that Merrimack has struggled a lot at the X this year, and I think Lemoyne is going to, if they can control things, they're going to come up on the better side here. But, you know, Merrimack is built for runs and built for comebacks. So I really think this is going to be like a 11-10 thriller. And I couldn't even pick a winner, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think no doubt this game is going to be within two goals either way. You put it perfectly with just the contrasting styles. But, you know, they're contrasting, but they're also the same in a lot of ways. It's just a really fun rivalry, I guess, unless you're one of the coaches in it, then it's probably not so much fun for those few hours as much as it's the most stressful few hours of your week, and you get to do it three times every year. So that's the North. That game's going to be explosive. Limestone is facing Uwindi in the South. Now, this definitely feels like, you know, this is Limestone's comeback year, and they're going to roll. But Kyle, you talked to the Uwindi program earlier in the year and did a feature story for them in the magazine. You know, this is a team that's kind of, it's been building for this moment, hasn't it?
Yeah, shout to Coach Stocks. I will get you copies of that magazine article. Sorry, I did not send those out yet. I think, you know, this is a team that only lost to Belmont Abbey earlier in the season, and then they avenge it in a tornado-delayed game that was almost 3 hours delayed. For the last, like, 47 seconds, they played it out, went to overtime. Belmont Abbey had a chance. Didn't drop for him, and UND, you know, buried him. And I think this is a team that there is not a lot of scout on, not a lot of info on. But I will tell you that, you know, their best player is no surprise, and especially in D2, a big, burly Canadian named Parker Kump from Surrey, British Columbia. He has 58 goals and 21 assists. He's big. He's strong. He gets his shot off anywhere on the field, and they don't even have to really run him off of picks or anything. He's very, this is going to come off kind of crazy to a lot of people that are pro lacrosse fans, but he's very Crowley-esque, Kevin Crowley-esque in his approach. Not crazy fast, but just so big and imposing and deceptively quick. Fast and quick, I think, are two different things that he can, you know, get a shot off on any defender. And he's gotten better at passing out of doubles as well. Drew Billig is the guy who scored the game-winning goal in overtime against Belmont Abbey. He's exceptional as well. He's a freshman midfielder from Brighton. Michigan, he's their second-leading scorer. You know, that's a guy to look out for as well. So, you know, this UIndy team, I think Limestone might be at a disadvantage because they haven't, you know, probably isn't a lot of tape on them. And they're going to have to dig deep in those streaming archives to try and find something to exploit. And I think everyone knows what Limestone offers. So one of the things that Tampa did really well against Limestone is milking the clock. I wrote about this and I tweeted about it as I was watching it. Tampa's goals against Limestone were unbelievable. They were all highlight level. Like, if you can put distant shots on highlights, which you should, they were amazing. The location, the velocity, the placement of everything they put on cage was immaculate. And then they milked out another possession. They got a lot. They drew a lot of what I'm calling micro fouls, which are like pushes without possession or interference calls, where all of those reset the shot clock. So if you're a team that's very good at drawing those, which, by the way, number one team that I've seen draw those and do a good job of it is Amherst in the D3 ranks, then you have a shot at beating Limestone because Limestone is very physical and they will foul you. So if you can get a bunch of those and milk down the clock, which also UIndy very good at, there's a shot. This is not I don't think this is a blowout unless Limestone gets rolling. And I think that UIndy has the tools to slow them down.
UIndy battle tested. 4 of their last 5 games have been 1-goal victories. So to your point, Kyle, if they can grind it down, they've been there at the end of the game when they needed one or they needed to kill some clock. They're going to be very familiar with that situation.
No matter what happens, it's going to be an awesome weekend. I think we're getting a lot of 1-goal games. I think we're going to get, at least at the D3 level, we're going to get someone who is a first-time team into the national championship game. We may not get that in D2. We might have some of the kind of classic battles that we've had, but that's fun too. So either way, it's going to be an awesome weekend. We are looking forward to following it. We will put our staff picks on the Inside the Cross Instagram account this weekend, and we will circle back next week for, it's hard to believe it, but an NCAA tournament championship preview. Can't believe it's the end of May coming already. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe if you're not already a subscriber, like and comment and rate us if you could. Thanks for listening.
This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.